From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the January 2020 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Enigma Unlocked. 80 years ago, in January 1940, British and French troops were freezing in their dugouts, awaiting a German attack which would not come for several months yet, the so-called phony war. By contrast, Bletchley Park was a hive of activity, as efforts were made to break into German codes and ciphers, including the Enigma system, before the land war began in earnest. In this It Happened Here episode, we're guided by Bletchley Park's research historian, Dr. David Kenyon, through the evolution of this infamous cipher machine and the international efforts which led to the unlocking of its secrets in January 1940. As usual, special thanks go to Mr. Ben Thompson for voicing our archival documents.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
We're standing in the pouring rain at the side of a French road, a road squelching with mud and lined right away over the plain to the far skyline with the inevitable double row of poplars. It's a grey, cold, dismal day. A few lorries only are splashing by to and from the forward areas. But coming down the road towards us is a battalion that I know to be of a famous Irish regiment. They're marching in threes, and in their full battle dress and kit, they blend with the dripping green grass of the roadside and the brown of the haystacks. As they passed us on that road, with their brown capes glistening and their tin hats perched on their heads, I thought how similar this must be to pictures of the last war. The road, the trees, the rain, and the everlasting beat of feet.
We're picking up today on our previous episodes about early days, and we're looking at January 1940. David, can you give us a bit of background about what was happening at that time?
Well, the traditional view of January 1940 is that not very much was happening, in fact. War had been declared back in September 1939, and a British expeditionary force, an army, had been sent to France, starting in September, essentially, and was completely ready to fight before Christmas. But the Germans didn't invade in the West. They fought the campaign in Poland and then stopped, essentially. So you have a period where the Western allies, Britain and France, are waiting to see what the Germans will do next. This period has been referred to as the phony war because the troops were all there, but no one was fighting anybody. That's a bit of a misnomer because although the BEF in France wasn't engaged in combat, there was certainly fighting going on. The air war had begun. The RAF was attempting to bomb Germany. There were German raids on the UK. And also at sea, there had been a number of significant actions, including the sinking of the Graf Spee in 1939. So there is fighting going on, but the main land battle with the Germans hasn't started yet in the West.
Meanwhile, at Bletchley Park, was it a similar story? Was it relatively quiet?
Bletchley Park was very, very busy during this period because the Codebreakers had learnt that German armed forces were using a version of Enigma to encrypt their traffic. And so the big priority for Bletchley was to figure out a way to break those messages. And the reason we're talking about this now is because it was in January of 1940, specifically we think on Monday the 22nd of January, that the first break of an Enigma message, wartime Enigma message, took place at Bletchley Park.
I think that will surprise quite a lot of people who might believe that Enigma was something that had featured since the start of the war, that Bletchley Park was reading messages right from the beginning of war breaking out.
The situation in September 39 was quite different. There is a comment in one of the histories that GCNCS hadn't read a German message for 20 years at that point, because from the moment the Germans start using variants of Enigma, their traffic becomes very, very difficult to read. And GCNCS had not been able to read any of it. Doesn't mean work hadn't been going on Enigma, and that's something we'll come on to. But it wasn't until January that they were able to read a message for the first time.
And just so that we get a bit of context, what did Bletchley Park look like at this time? Was it a big organisation in January 1940?
As we heard in the earlier podcast, it had been growing very rapidly since September, but it still wasn't a huge organisation. They had moved out of the mansion. The first half dozen huts, at least, were in place. And the teams that would go on to be famous in those huts had already been established. In fact, a team to work on Enigma, the team that would become Hut 6, was set up back in December. So they were already getting themselves into a position so that they could exploit Enigma the moment they figured out how to break it. So they were kind of trying to get all their pieces on the board in place so that the moment they figured out how to crack the cipher, they could hit the ground running and exploit it as much as possible.
Would you say there was a turning point then in January 1940 that particularly meant that this was the time that the first Enigma break took place?
There is. It's the culmination of 3 months of work that started in September.
So interest in Enigma didn't just start in September 1939?
No, the history of Enigma and the history of various countries' attempts to break Enigma actually goes back a lot longer than that. It goes right back to the beginning of the First World War.
For several days, I've reported, or repeated to you, calls for ambulance drivers, stretcher bearers, and other personnel of the civilian defense. It might be useful to request the services of a good sociologist. Because if this business of repeated air raid alarms goes on, the sociological results will be considerable. This is a class-conscious country. People live in the same small street or apartment building for years and never talk to each other. The man with a fine car, good clothes, and perhaps an unearned income doesn't generally fraternize with the tradesmen, day laborers, and truck drivers. His fences are always up. He doesn't meet them as equals. He is surrounded with certain evidences of worldly wealth calculated to keep others at a distance. But if he's caught in Piccadilly Circus when the sirens sound, he may have a waitress stepping on his heels and see before him the broad back of a day laborer as he goes underground. If the alarm sounds about 4 a.m, as it did this morning, his dignity, reserve, and authority may suffer when he arrives half-dressed and sleepy, minus his usual defenses and possessed of no more courage than those others who have arrived in similar state. Someone, I think it was Marcus Aurelius, said something to the effect that death put Alexander of Macedon and his stable boy on a par. Repeated visits to public air raid shelters might have produced the same results. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm not a very good sociologist. But I can tell you this from personal experience. That siren would improve your knowledge of even your most intimate friend. London, as usual, is black tonight. One gets accustomed to it. But it can hardly be called pleasant. I don't know how you feel about people who smoke cigarettes, but I like them, particularly at night in London. That small, dull red glow is a very welcome sight. It prevents collisions and makes it unnecessary to heave to until you locate the exact position of those vague voices in the darkness. One night several years ago, I walked bang into a cow, and since then I've had a desire for man and beast to carry running lights on dark nights. They can't do that in London these nights, but cigarettes are a good substitute. For a moment tonight, I thought I was back in the London of Mr. Pickwick's time. I heard a voice booming through these dark London streets. It said, 28 Portland Place, all's well. It was an air raid warden. He'd shouted them an order to cover their window. They had done so. And so he was telling them that no more light came through.
Can you tell us a little bit about the history of the Enigma machine? Where did it come from? What are its origins?
Well, the first thing you have to appreciate about Enigma is it's not a single machine. There were 20 or 25 different varieties of Enigma produced at different times. So it's better thought of as a cipher system that evolves from the very first machine that was produced in 1918 through to the last machines, the last versions of the machine and the adaptations to it that happened quite near the end of the war. And indeed, there are cipher machines that are being invented in the latter part of the Second World War that go on to be used afterwards, which take inspiration from the same kind of technology. It's also not the only machine that uses this particular approach to encipherment. There are other machines, there's the British Typex machine, there's other bits and pieces that all kind of form a family of the similar encryption method.
So what is it that makes Enigma, Enigma?
What makes Enigma, Enigma is using wheels or rotors to transpose letters. Most people will be familiar with what's called a substitution cipher, which is where you take the letters of the alphabet and you replace each letter with a different letter. And you can either do that just by shifting the alphabet along a certain number of characters so that the offset is consistent, or a better way to do it would be to completely jumble the letters up and just allocate at random, you know, Z to B and J to R and whatever. The problem with that is if you do that, it's a very easy cipher to break, because you can use frequency analysis and other techniques to work out which letter represents which letter. At the most basic level, the fact that in English messages have lots of E's in them means you just count up the most frequently occurring letter in the ciphertext, and that's probably E. So it's actually a very basic, easily broken cipher. The clever part with Enigma and machines like it is they create that random alphabet, but they constantly change it. On Enigma, you have these rotors which have one of those transpositions on each wheel, and every time you press a key, the wheels move so that the transpositions change. So your alphabet of cipher letters for the first letter of your message is different from the alphabet of cipher letters for your second letter of your message, and so on. And that's what makes it difficult to break, is that the cipher is constantly changing. But there are actually two parts to the military Enigma machine that make it very difficult to break. Those rotors are the first part, and early Enigma machines only had the rotor system. Later, the Germans add what's called a plug board on the front, which creates another letter substitution, which doesn't change while you're typing your message. But what it does is it masks the transpositions that are going on in the rotor, so it makes it much harder for an external code breaker to see what's going on. And the mature machine that the Germans use has both rotors and a plug board, and as a consequence, is theoretically a very, very powerful cipher system.
Let's go right back to the beginning. When was Enigma invented and who invented it?
The very first Enigma-branded machine was developed by a 40-year-old German in 1918, a man called Arthur Scherbius. He was an electrical engineer and inventor, and he's otherwise known for patents around electrical devices. He made ceramic heaters. He made an electric pillow. He didn't make any money with any of these things. He was one of those people that was always inventing things and never getting rich. Interestingly, a couple of years earlier in 1915, a similar concept was outlined by two Dutch cryptographers. They invented a rotor machine, and there was another expert who invented one as well. So this concept of using wheels to create a substitution cipher is kind of out there in the ether. Various people are working on it. But the first person who produces a practical commercial machine is Arthur Scherbius in 1918. And the patents that he took out at that point in Germany survive, so we know quite a lot about the first device that he invented. The first machine that he builds is not terribly similar to the wartime Enigma that we're mostly familiar with. It's a much bigger device, and it was intended to work a bit like an electric typewriter. It had a paper roll in it, and you could type your text, and the ciphertext was actually printed onto a piece of paper. Obviously, when you hit a key on the keyboard, the letter that gets printed on the paper isn't the same letter, it's a different one, but it functions essentially like a typewriter. The problem with that is it weighed about 50 kilos, and it was a massive, very complicated and very expensive device. So he produces a few and starts trying to sell them, but he basically gets nowhere. Nobody's particularly interested in it.
Who was he trying to sell them to? Who was the most likely market for this kind of machine?
Well, he originally thought he might be able to sell it to governments and to militaries around the world. He did have in mind a military application for it. But also, we're talking about the heyday of telegraphic communication, telegrams going around the world, businesses relying on telegrams in the way that we rely on, you know, email today. So there was a big market for systems that would allow you to encrypt confidential commercial telegrams. And there were a variety of codes and cipher systems commercially available. You could go out and buy books that would allow you to encrypt your commercially sensitive telegrams. So it's quite realistic for him to expect to sell it into the civilian market as well as the commercial market. Unfortunately, as I said, he doesn't generate any interest with the early what's referred to as the printer Enigma. So he kind of goes back to the drawing board, and he devises a smaller and cheaper machine, and he gets rid of all of the typewriter part of it and the paper, and comes up with a machine where when you press a key, a lamp comes on underneath a glass panel with letters marked on it.
And this is what a lot of people recognise.
This is what people recognise as the military Enigma that we're all familiar with. You know, you press the letter A and the encrypted letter J or B or whatever it is will light up on a panel. The problem with that is it makes it quite slow to use because, unlike the typewriter machine, you have to press the key, hold it down to keep the light on, write down what the encryption is, and then let go and then press the next letter. However, he went to the Universal Postal Union Congress in Stockholm in 1924, and he took his big typewriter machine, but he also took one of these smaller devices, what's referred to as the glow lamp machine, because of the lights it had. It's much smaller, much more portable, and essentially much cheaper to manufacture. And it's this machine that really attracts any attention, unlike the big previous one. Nobody buys it particularly at Stockholm, but there's enough interest for him to go into production with what we know as the first commercial glow lamp Enigma machine, the Enigma A, as it's known. And that starts being manufactured in 1925. Unfortunately for Scherbius, just at the point where he might be making a success of it, he's got a company, they're making the machines, and people are taking interest in the machines. He was killed in a horse and carriage accident.
So fame and fortune didn't follow him.
Fame and fortune eluded him even then. And it's ironic that just at the point where he might have made some money, he died. But the company carried on going, and Willy Korn, who was his sort of assistant in the designing of the machines, carried on working on the machine, and it lived on after him.
This was probably the dullest day of the war, which is saying something. But there's no present prospect that the war is going to be called off, and before long the peoples of Western Europe may look back to the good old days when it was dull. Prime Minister Chamberlain will make his weekly report to the House of Commons, probably on Wednesday, and the London Dispatch tonight predicts that he will say that Hitler's proposal for a general conference on the future of Europe might be accepted on these three conditions: that the Germans must not go into the conference claiming the right to keep all they have conquered, that they must be ready to discuss other topics besides colonies and disarmament, which Hitler suggested, such topics perhaps as the restoration of Poland and of Czechoslovakia, and that Germany must recognize the refugee Polish government and agree to its taking part in the conference too. Now, there's no visible reason to suppose that Hitler will even consider these terms. He has insisted that the Polish question will be settled entirely between Germany and Russia, and he regards the Czechoslovak question as closed. But at least this helps to define the issue and makes it harder for Hitler to represent himself as the sole champion of peace. He says he will stop the war on certain terms. The Allies say they will stop it on certain other terms. There seems to be some hope in London that Hitler will then come up with new and more acceptable proposals, but not if you believe what he said yesterday. Well, it appears from Hitler's speech that when he speaks of the rights of peoples, he means the rights of some peoples, the Germans first, then the Russians, and perhaps still the Italians too, if you get around to them. But not the rights of the Polish people or the Czech people or the Albanian people. This is not a question of moral theory, but of practical politics. It is clear enough that Poland, for instance, can never have a secure future except in reasonable harmony with Germany and Russia. That is a mere question of comparative force. So also, Czechoslovakia can have no secure future without some reasonable basis of getting along with Germany. But there is no evidence in history that the kind of solution of the Czech problem which the Germans have made, the kind of solution of the Polish problem which the Germans and Russians are making, will be any more durable than the solution of those problems that was written into the treaties of 1919. In other words, and it is worth remembering this in the present interlude, while war aims are being discussed and before the fighting really begins, it is not a choice between a practical and realistic solution proposed by the authoritarian states and the cloudy idealism of the democracies. It is a choice between two solutions of Eastern European problems, of which one will not work unless the Nazi state proves far more just to minorities or far more efficient in oppression than the old empires, while the other will not work without more goodwill than can be found in Europe at present. There is likely to be even less after this war was over. President Roosevelt announced that an unidentified submarine had been seen 15 miles off Miami, 285 miles within the safety zone. Of course, the safety zone declaration doesn't say that belligerent warships must keep out, only that they mustn't do any fighting. But what are they there for? American neutrality is a serious matter. It seems a pity that it threatens to provide the war with comic relief.
And who was buying this machine then, if it was successful commercially?
Well, in the early days of the mid-1920s, he gets contracts from various governments. The Swedish government take an interest in it early on and order a batch of machines from him. But also a number of other governments get involved. And what's quite exciting, that I was sent just last year by an Enigma researcher who's a good friend of Bletchley Park, Frode Farad. He sent me a document which is actually from 1935, but it is a catalogue of the serial numbers of all the model 1926 machines that were sold around the world. These are this first commercial version of the machine. And it's quite striking because we think of Enigma as essentially a German device, and maybe by the Swiss or during the Spanish Civil War. But there are 159 machines on this list. And in alphabetical order, I can tell you the countries that bought them. Afghanistan bought 7. The Americans bought 2. Argentina, 10. Chile, 16. Germany, 14. England bought 2. The French bought 2. The Dutch bought some. Italy, Mexico, Austria, Poland, Russia, Sweden, Czechoslovakia, and Hungary. So there's a lot of governments getting on board. In the case of the British, this isn't necessarily because they want to use it, but because it's out there and other people are likely to be using it, you want to get one and have a look at it.
You said Germany had 14 of those machines.
Yeah.
When did Germany first get their hands on an Enigma machine? Because as you say, it's most closely allied with Germany. People think of it as a German machine.
Well, Schoebius was himself a German, and he demonstrated the machine to the military and the government in Germany at a number of stages, and they were kind of following his progress. It's in 1924 when he comes up with this first commercial version, the first glow lamp machine, that the German government kind of finally goes, actually, this is one we can use. And they bought 10 in 1924. And then in 1927, the machine is officially adopted by the Reichswehr, which is the German army. The German army at that point has been limited by the Treaty of Versailles after World War I. So it's a very small force. It's only 100,000 men. And it has all sorts of constraints on what it's allowed to do under the treaty. But it is developing its signals operation and it needs a cipher system for its signaling. So the Reichswehr buy up the machine in 1927 and they take that machine and analyze it and they realize that as it stands, it has vulnerabilities. And that's when they introduce the plug board to the front of the machine to make it more secure. And the machine that comes into production for the German army is an improved model, which comes into use in 1932, that has the plug board on the front. What the German government have actually done is they've also bought the company at that point. So they're manufacturing to their own specification. The company continues to sell to foreign customers, but it's that point it's basically wholly owned by the German government. And the versions of the machine that they sell overseas are different from the one that they adopt for their own forces because it maintains the security of their own one.
So what were the characteristics of this machine at this point? You said it has a plug board on the front.
It has a plug board on the front and it has 3 encryption rotors in the back. It's quite small. It's about, I suppose, about 1 foot wide, about 18 inches deep, and about 6 inches with the lid shut in the box. And it comes basically in a wooden box. You open the lid and you have the keyboard there in front of you and an on-off switch. Switch it on, and there's a little battery pack that provides enough power just to create the electric circuit to light the bulbs. So it doesn't need very much power. The rotors are actually turned by a lever mechanism from the pressure you put on the key. So it doesn't have to turn any of its wheels electrically. The only thing the electrical power does is light the lights. And the difference between the German army machine and the commercial machines, and one of the things that's difficult for enemies of Germany to find out, is each of the rotors, the substitution that takes place in there, you know, if a letter goes in at one point, what letter it comes out as, the wiring internally in each rotor is unique to the German armed forces and is kept secret. Because you can have exactly the same machine, but if the rotors are wired in a different way, it produces a completely different encryption. So having a machine that looks to all intents and purposes like the German army one, but with the wrong wiring in the rotors, doesn't get you any further forward.
So unless you actually have a rotor that you can break into and check that wiring.
Check the wiring out, you're stuck. And most of the countries that adopt the machine, the first thing they do is come up with their own private wiring for the rotors, and that makes it secure. The commercial machine, if you just bought it off the shelf, you would have got standard commercially wired rotors. The unfortunate thing about that is it means everybody else who's using it has the same rotors as you, so it's not massively secure.
First Lord of the Admiralty answers Nazi propaganda, and he speaks in language that they can understand.
Nowadays, we are assailed by a chorus of hurried threats. The Nazi government exudes to every neutral state inside information about the frightful vengeance they are going to wreak upon us, and they also bawl it round the world by their propaganda machinery. If words could kill, we should be dead already. We are in a very different position from that we were in 10 weeks ago. We are far stronger than we were 10 weeks ago. We are far better prepared to endure the worst malice of Hitler and his Huns than we were at the beginning of September. General Goering, and he is one of the few Germans who has been having a pretty good time for the last 2 years, General Goering says that we have been spared so far because Nazi Germany is so humane. They cannot bear to do anything to hurt anybody. All they ask for is the right to live and to be let alone to conquer and kill the weak. Their humanity forbids them to apply severities to the strong. I shall not attempt to prophesy whether the frenzy of a cornered maniac will drive Herr Hitler into the worst of all his crimes. But this I will say, without a doubt, that the fate of Holland and Belgium, like that of Poland, Czechoslovakia and Austria, will be decided by the victory of the British Empire and the French Republic. If we are conquered, all will be enslaved, and the United States will be left single-handed to guard the rights of men.
You're describing machine quite early on. That sounds very familiar to people who would know perhaps about Enigma machines that were being used in sort of 1945. It doesn't seem as if a lot has changed with the machine between that period of time. Is that true?
Essentially, the Enigma I, as it's known, the machine that's introduced in the early 1930s for the German army, stays pretty much the same for the rest of the war. What changes is the procedures the Germans use in operation of the machine, how they conceal the settings they're using to send the messages. And in the very latter part of the war, they do invent additional pieces of hardware, sort of contraptions that you can plug into an existing Enigma machine that increase the complexity of the encryption.
Like the Enigma UR.
And there's things that allow you to change the plug board and one thing another. But by the time they've issued, you know, tens of thousands of these machines to their military, they can't just start again and issue one with a fresh one. The only real change that happens is with the naval machines. The Navy introduce an M1 machine, which is essentially identical to the Army and Air Force machine, to the I. The difference between the two of them visually is when you look at them is that the naval machine has a plug socket on the front of it that allows you to plug it into the power supply from the ship that it's on or the submarine, which means you don't have to use the battery. So an easy way to tell them apart is if there's a plug socket, it's a naval machine. If it hasn't, it's an Army machine. And that machine went under minor modifications, and there was an M1, an M2, and an M3. And by the time you get to the outbreak of war, most of the Navy is using the M3. There is a misconception that it's called M3 because it has three rotors. Mm-hmm. That's actually coincidental. There's been an M1 and an M2.
Right.
In 1942, the German Navy introduced famously their four-rotor Enigma machine, which has another rotor in it. That rotor isn't interchangeable with the other ones. It's slightly more technical than that. That machine coincidentally is known as an M4 because it comes after the M3, but it also has four rotors.
Right.
So some people think M3 equals three rotors, M4 equals four rotors. It does, but it's coincidental.
Right.
It's not why they're called that. But essentially, the modifications that the Navy make when they produce the M4 machine, that's broadly the only big change that happens with the military machines. At the same time, those aren't the only machines the Germans are using. The German intelligence service, the Abwehr, continues to use a machine that is much more like the civilian commercial machine. It doesn't have a plug board. They change the rotor wirings, but it's broadly similar to the commercial machine. And it's actually easier to break. And then there are other more specialist machines kind of kicking around. There's a particular machine that is produced for communications between the German government and the Japanese government. But that's you know, compared to the number of standard eye machines that are around, those ones are only a tiny fraction of what's going on. So the main target for the Allied powers after 1939 is this basic Enigma I Army Air Force machine. It's also used by the Navy. So there's kind of one model that you're attacking.
So the majority of encrypted communications will be using that machine. Right. For the sake of completeness, the three-rotor machine didn't only have three rotors and the four-rotor machine didn't only have four rotors to choose from.
That's correct. One of the ways you can modify the machine is you can take the rotors out and you can put them in a different order. So if you have the basic machine with three rotors, there are six possibilities of rotor order that you can put in. 3 × 2 × 1. The German army latterly introduce an additional pair of rotors in 1938. So they then have five. And if you look at each rotor, it has a little Roman numeral on it. They're numbered 1 to 5. So you can swap them around. 5 rotors increases your possibilities from 3 times 2 times 1, which is 6, to 5 times 4 times 3 times 2 times 1, which is 60. So you've got a tenfold increase in your complexity by introducing those 2 additional rotors. The German Navy do something very similar, and they introduce an additional 3 rotors in 1939. So naval operators have a choice of 8 that they can put in the machine. And that theoretically would give you over 300 possibilities. Actually, one of the reasons they've done it is they insist that any rotor order you choose has to include one of rotors 6, 7, and 8. Because what that means is if you send a message which uses one of the 3 exclusively naval rotors, somebody with an army machine with only the first 5 would not be able to read that message because they wouldn't have the appropriate rotor to do it.
Right.
So they actually use fewer than 300 different combinations. And that actually works to the Allies' advantage because it lessens the complexity of the machine or the number of choices that the Allies have to work through.
And Enigma machine operators were provided with instructions on how to set up these machines, which rotors to choose, which order to put them, and so on and so forth.
Yes, this is where we get to the real security of Enigma and similar cipher systems. Various rather notorious Hollywood films will suggest that in order to break Enigma, all you need to do is capture an Enigma machine. And once you've got the machine, you can read everybody else's messages. The beauty of the machine is that that doesn't apply. Even if you had a German eye machine exactly the same as the message you'd intercepted had been encrypted with, you would still be nowhere because the secrecy lies in the particular setup of the machine when the message is encrypted. And that comes from a choice of which rotors are in the machine. The rotors also have an adjustable alphabetical ring around them, which can be moved into any one of 26 positions. There's also the plug board on the front of the machine. The transpositions there can be changed around in all sorts of different ways. In the early days, the Germans only have a small number of cables in the plug board, so not all of the letters of the alphabet get transposed. They start off with about 6 pairs being transposed, so only 12 letters would be swapped and the other 14 letters would be unswapped.
So just to make clear, the plug board switches one letter for another and that goes back in the machine. Yeah.
They never use 13 cables. They never switch all 26 letters because mathematically, actually, if you leave the option of some of them being non-transposed, you actually have a wider range of possibilities. So the most effective number of plug cables to use is 11. Actually, the German military end up using 10. So they're pretty much on the money. This particular way that a machine is set up before you send a message is referred to as a key. And in modern parlance, we talk about a key space. This is the number of possible setups that any encryption system can use. Modern internet cipher systems mostly rely on keys consisting of binary numbers. And so they talk about the length of the binary number. And you'll talk about like a 128-bit encryption. The longer the key number, the more secure the system is. Because in order to try every possibility, it would take you longer and longer and longer. The key space for an Army Air Force Enigma machine is a bit of a contested subject. The number we go for is 103,000 million, 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 which is, in modern parlance, a 77-bit encryption, which is pretty good. Until relatively recently, that would have been considered quite secure.
Well, now we know where the Russians stand for the moment. Russia is the friend of peace-loving Germany and dislikes those imperialistic aggressors, England and France, and doesn't think much of the United States either. But Russia will give Germany only political support and will remain neutral. That is the substance of the speech made today in Moscow by Premier and Foreign Commissar Molotov. He said, too, that if the Finns didn't come to an agreement with Russia, that would work out to the serious detriment of Finland. But he also outlined the terms Russia has proposed to Finland, which are not so extensive as has sometimes been reported, though from the reaction in Helsinki tonight, they may be more than the Finns will accept. Further points that he brought out, Russia wants the war to end, and Germany, too, is striving for peace. England and France are the aggressors because they want to continue the war, not for the sake of Poland or democracy, but for their colonial interests. It is not only senseless but criminal to wage a war for the destruction of Hitlerism, camouflaged as a fight for democracy. Ideologies cannot be destroyed by force, said Mr. Molotov, which is a curious comment on the Russian repression of opinion that disagrees with the government. He added that a strong Germany is an indispensable condition for the durable peace of Europe. As for Finland, Molotov said that Russia wants to move the Finnish frontier back out of gunshot of Leningrad, several dozen kilometers farther, but is willing to compensate Finland with territory farther north. The Finns are also asked to disarm their fortified frontier zones and to lease Russia some territory near the mouth of the Gulf of Finland for a naval base. and there is mention of additional mutual guarantees, whatever that means. On the other hand, Molotov declared that Russia does not object to Finland's fortifying the Åland Islands. However, the Finns were furious tonight when they found out that the terms had been published, as they had apparently hoped to reduce them by further negotiation. Especially disturbing was the demand for the disarming of the fortified frontier. The Finnish mission, already on its way to Moscow, was ordered to stop at Viborg before reaching the border while the government considered the matter. Molotov's language sounds as if the Finns must sign on the dotted line or else. But what used to be fighting words in diplomacy are commonplaces now, so perhaps the dispute will still be settled without fighting.
All of this rather esoteric conversation about key spaces, the thing to remember about it is it's not possible to break the Enigma for good and all and, you know, be able to read messages for the rest of your life. Most of the parts of the key used by German operators would change every day. And even then, within that one day, each message would have a slightly different setting, that the exact position of the machine when each individual message was sent would change. So breaking Enigma in common parlance actually means key finding. It means every time the Germans change the key they're using, the way they're setting up the machine, which they typically did daily, you need to start again. You need to figure out that key all over again. Also, all of the German armed forces aren't using the same key every day. They're using a multiplicity of different keys. So this isn't a process you just have to do once a day. You have to do it many times a day. So the secret of unlocking Enigma traffic for the Allies is working out a way by which you can figure out what key is being used by which network each day. Once you can do that, you're in. But you have to repeat the process. You have to set up a system whereby you can do it daily. And that's the clever part, if you like.
So there's no unlocking the Enigma machine. There's no one machine to be unlocked. There's no one key that will help you read everything. And it changes so frequently that it's a constant battle.
Yes. Not only do you have to do it every day, but as I described earlier, the Germans at various points in the war change their operating procedures. And where there are breaking methods that rely on the eccentricities of those particular operating procedures, if those procedures are changed even quite slightly, it can render one key finding method obsolete. And then you then have to come up with another key finding method. So the Enigma teams at Bletchley Park are always on this kind of cliff edge of, will the Germans keep doing things the way we figured out, or will they change things and then we'll be in the dark again? And this does happen with Naval Enigma when the Germans change the four-rotor machine. It basically knocks out everything Naval Section has been doing up to that point, and they have to figure out a new way of doing things. So you can't break Enigma and then sit back and go, right, we've done that, let's see what the Germans are discussing. You have to keep on it all the time, and it's a fight every day.
So it makes a little more sense that the first break of Enigma at Bletchley Park was January 1940, that they weren't sitting on their hands until then. A huge amount of work had been done.
That's right. A huge amount of work had been done up to this point in January. And all they've done when they get to this moment of the break is figure out the work they're going to have to do every day for the foreseeable future. They can't sit back at that point and go, oh, we've done this. All they've done is, as I say, developed a methodology that they can then keep using.
Thinking back to what you were saying before about the various countries that had bought the early versions of the Enigma machine, and you mentioned a couple of machines had come to the UK, so Enigma wasn't completely unknown to them. The work that they were doing was based on a certain understanding of Enigma. When did Britain first learn about the Enigma machine?
Britain first became familiar with the machine in the 1920s. Sherbius actually travelled to London and demonstrated an early version of his machine to the Foreign Office and took out patents in the UK so that he could manufacture the machine in the UK or he could sell it to UK customers. The Foreign Office weren't particularly interested in the machine, but obviously this was the new kid on the block in terms of code and cipher systems. So GC&CS had a responsibility to understand it. So they purchased two machines in Vienna in Austria in 1926, brought them back to London, and they did a sort of twofold assessment. One part of it was to understand whether this might be technology that the British wanted to adopt for their own use. And the second sneakier layer, if you like, was even if we don't want to use it ourselves, let's see how vulnerable it is in case other people start using it. And the first person to do that work was Hugh Foss, who's a Bletchleyite who we've referred to in the past.
That's quite a familiar name.
He's a very, very clever cryptographer. He went on to be more famous, arguably, for his work on Japanese codes and ciphers later on. He had a very broad skill set. And he basically got the machine that GC&CS had bought and took it apart and probed its innards and did all sorts of mathematical calculations. He wrote a report in 1928 entitled The Reciprocal Enigma, which survives in the National Archives.
The Reciprocal Enigma, General Explanation. The ciphering is done by 26 keys, 26 lights, and 4 wheels. 3 of the wheels are thoroughfares, and the 4th causes a return. When a key is pressed, the first right-hand wheel is moved round one place, and then the electrical connection is made. When any wheel comes into position 1, the wheel on the left is at the same time moved one place. The wheels 1, 2, and 3 can be put in any order. All the wheels have tires marked with letters, which can take up any position relative to the wheels. The primary setting consists of the setting of these tires. The secondary setting refers to the letters on the tire opposite the red line in figure 2. The primary setting could be used for a period of time, and the secondary setting could be different for each message and sent with it.
What he was able to demonstrate there was not only how the machine worked, but that without the plugboard on the front, the basic commercial machine was fundamentally vulnerable. There was a mathematical way of key finding from the text of a message. If you intercepted a message and you knew a little bit about it, you could potentially unpick it mathematically and break it. And it's potentially his realization that it's not a particularly secure machine that leads the British government not to buy it. But because at that point, the German military haven't adopted it full scale, and it's not really being used to any great extent in Europe, that file kind of goes on a shelf. Foss's work is put on one side. Go, yeah, we know about this machine. We don't particularly want to use it ourselves. You know, if it becomes an issue in the future, we know what to do. And that's how the situation kind of rests for the next few years.
So if this report is sitting on a shelf waiting for an Enigma machine to start becoming a threat, when does it start being looked at again?
The Germans start using Enigma, as we discussed, from the early 1930s, but they're not fighting a war at that point. They're using it for training, and a lot of their operations are, their focus is towards the east, towards Poland. So what little Enigma traffic they're sending is training messages anyway, and is quite hard to intercept from the UK, so it's not really being heard by GCNCS listening stations. The situation changes in 1936 with the start of the Spanish Civil War. And at that point, Franco's forces adopt a version of the commercial Enigma machine. This is a version that is also used by the fascist government in Italy and by Nazi Germany. And the idea is that those two powers are supporting Franco's forces, and it allows the three of them to intercommunicate. What this means is the traffic is real military traffic in the first case, so it has intelligence value. Secondly, because messages are going to and from Spain, they're much easier for the British to intercept. And actually, an allied Franco-British intercept station is set up in the Pyrenees, which is perfectly poised to hear all of the traffic coming out of Spain. At that point, Dilly Knox, who's another famous Bletchley codebreaker who'd done work during the First World War, he starts tackling this material. And he develops a technique known as rodding. And this is a kind of hand-based pencil and paper system. He basically wrote alphabets on strips of cardboard, which reflected the influence the rotors had on the ciphertext. And by manipulating the strips of cardboard in a very long and tedious way, to be honest, you can actually unpick the messages and you can break Enigma. That methodology works because these machines, like the commercial machine, don't have the plugboard. If you had a plugboard, rodding basically wouldn't work. This has led to Knox being given quite a lot of the credit for the first British breaks of any sorts of Enigma traffic. Actually, the rodding technique that he's using draws a lot on Foss's analysis of the machine from back in 1928. So Foss should be allowed some of the credit for that breakthrough, not just Knox. But anyway, Knox gets a team going at GCNCS who are able to read Spanish Civil War Enigma traffic.
So in 1936, Enigma traffic is being read. Enigma, in theory, is being broken, but it's not the Enigma machine we're familiar with the plug board. So when we say the first Enigma break, January 1940, we're talking about the Enigma with the plug board, even though these early breaks led into that kind of work.
Actually, the first breaks of the German plug board Enigma, the Enigma I, go way back to when it was first introduced in the early 1930s, but they don't happen in the UK. And this is where we have to internationalize the story and look at the work that the Poles and the French were doing on Enigma. And so we have to kind of double back and start again in the story of Enigma at this point.
The other afternoon, I spent several hours underground studying the central control station of London's air raid precaution system. One man can sit in that room and move ambulances, stretcher parties, gas decontamination squads and repair parties, just as though he had them on the end of a string. The maps covering the walls
resemble those in an army headquarters. The whole system is linked to local units by direct telephone. And if the telephones don't work, there are motorcycle dispatch riders standing by to carry messages. If London is bombed, one could sit in that room and by reading colored pins and discs on the maps, tell just where bridges have been blown up, where fire engines are needed, where additional ambulances are required, and the position of reserve units which might be needed. It was quiet down there the other day. The elaborate maps on which one could follow the approach of enemy aircraft were clear. The bright little pins, which mean gas or railroad destroyed or serious fire, were sitting in a little box like toy soldiers. The telephone operators, young girls who might have been college sophomores at home, sat at their instruments knitting or reading. One was reading The Life of Madame Curie, another Tolstoy's War and Peace, and the latest detective thrillers were also in evidence. Occasionally, they practice a little. The telephone rings, the operator takes down a message, passes it through a slot to the control officer, and in a few minutes' time, an ambulance brigade or a covey of fire engines go racing through the streets in a remote part of London on a practice trip. The whole scheme seemed to be efficient and at the same time, easy to operate. The Minister of Food will announce in the House of Commons tomorrow the date for the introduction of rationing in Britain. And it is reported from Oslo that the Norwegian Nobel Committee has reached a decision on its annual peace award. It has decided not to award a peace prize for 1939. I return you now to Columbia in New York.
So who were the first to break Enigma? Is it possible to say that?
The first serious successes against the German military Enigma system were achieved by the Poles. And for this, we go again back to the end of the First World War. Poland has a long history of being partitioned and occupied by either the Germans or the Russians or the Austrians or sometimes all three. And it's only after the Treaty of Versailles that an independent Poland is internationally acknowledged. Their boundaries are reinstated and recognized internationally in 1923. The problem they have almost straight away is that a big chunk of the newly created Poland used to be Germany, and an equally big chunk of it used to be part of the Russian Empire. So they know that they're not popular with their neighbours. In the 1920s, the Poles are forced to fight a war against the Bolshevik Russians, who try and reclaim their bits of Poland. Fortunately for the Poles, they win, but it's pretty clear that either the Russians or the Germans are potentially going to attack sooner rather than later. So from the moment that the Germans start using Enigma for their military, it's an obvious thing for the Poles to start trying to figure it out and start trying to attack it. And as we've heard earlier, the Poles bought commercial versions of the machine the moment it came out, so they are familiar broadly with how an Enigma machine works, although they don't know particularly the internal wiring detail of the rotors on the German machine, and obviously they have the challenge of the plug board as well, but they're very keen to understand it. Process starts with an outfit called the Biuro Szyfrów, which is the Polish Cipher Bureau. That's part of the Polish General Staff Intelligence Department, Section 2 thereof. And in 1926, they acquire a commercial machine. They start studying it. And then in 1929, they realize they need staff to work on this. The Intelligence Department have the reasonably inspired idea that they need very, very clever mathematicians, but also they need mathematicians who understand German. And fortunately for them, Poznan used to be part of Germany, essentially. So people in Poznan will speak German, by and large. And they set up a cryptography course in the maths department of Poznan University. And the idea of this is that they will attract students who will just study cryptography for interest as part of their maths studies. But the intelligence department can spot the ones who are really good at it and then headhunt them, basically. And as a consequence of that course, which starts in 1929, the Biuro Szyfrów identify three Polish mathematics students who will go on to be very famous as the three chaps who understand and then break German military Enigma. And they are Marian Rzeczewski, Henryk Zygalski, and Jerzy Rosicki. Apologies to our Polish listeners for my pronunciation. These three math students go on to tackle military Enigma on behalf of the Polish intelligence service.
We talk about these three, but sometimes they're seen as the three kind of heads of or examples of, a bit like Turing and GCNCS, but it was just these three.
Yes. I mean, in contrast to when we talk about GCNCS and we often name individuals And we talk about Turing, and actually we're talking about Turing and his team, or Knox and the team that he assembled around him that included all sorts of other people, Peter Twin, you know, Jeffrey, the rest of them. In the Polish case, it literally was three guys with some assistance from their bosses who were the heads of the organization. But it was essentially these three mathematicians. And in the early days, it was just Rejewski. The secret wasn't shared with the other two until a little bit later on. So it is a really tiny number of people that are involved in the project. They are helped externally because they don't just have their understanding of how Enigma works and some German messages. They have material from the French. This comes about because the French intelligence service have what would be known as a walk-in, a German spy, traitor, who comes to the French and says, I can provide you with military secrets from Germany in exchange for money. And this is a man called Hans Thilo Schmidt. Schmidt wasn't particularly important in his own right, but his brother worked for the German signal service. So his brother was dealing with Enigma directly. And Hans managed to get a job with his brother in the signal service. Essentially, what he would do was he would borrow the materials that came across his desk, and he would travel out of Germany, either to France or to Switzerland, and meet with Gustave Bertrand, who was the head of the Service de Renseignement, the French military intelligence. And Bertrand would buy Schmidt a nice dinner, and the contents of his briefcase would be photographed in an upstairs room of the hotel, and then they'd give him his briefcase back, and he'd go back to Germany with lots of money. And this relationship continued for a number of years from 1931 onwards.
Schmidt is known as Asche. That was his code name.
Yes, which can either be spelt out in the German sense of A-S-C-H-E, or if you think about the letters H and E pronounced in French, Asche, either will do. And so he's providing Enigma-related materials to Bertrand, and Bertrand shares those materials with the Bureau Shufrov in Warsaw. The sorts of things he's getting, for example, he was able to provide a manual for the military machine. One of the challenges that the Poles have is figuring out how the rotors are wired, because until you know the individual wiring of the rotors, you can't reconstruct how the encryption works. You don't need the physical machine, because you can do the whole thing on paper, but you do need to understand how that wiring works. There was certainly paperwork that would have assisted. For example, the manual for the Enigma had a sample of plain text and a sample of ciphertext encrypted at a particular setting as a kind of exemplar in the book. And the virtue of that for a codebreaker is if you look at it, it gives you an example of how the ciphertext letters relate to the plain text letters. And it would help you to work out the wiring of the rotors. So helped by all this paperwork, but also by some blinding mathematics by Rejewski, the Poles are able to understand the wiring of the German military rotors and to reconstruct how it encrypts. Initially, they do this as a sort of paper exercise, but in 1933, the Polish intelligence service set up their own Enigma factory. They create a company called the AVA Radio Manufacturing Company, or its Polish equivalent, which is a company wholly owned by the intelligence service, and its job is to build analogues of the German Enigma machine. I say analogues because they're not direct replicas of the German machine. They replicate the functioning of the German machine, but they're assembled in a slightly different way and they look quite different. The plug board is on the back of the machine instead of the front, for example.
There's one of these in the Pilsudski Institute in London.
Yes, and you know, if you look on the internet, you can see pictures of them, and they are quite distinctive because the components are arranged in a different way, but they mimic exactly how the military Enigma machine worked. So what this means is the Poles understand the machine, and not only do they develop an analog for the machine, but they also develop a number of techniques of key finding, of breaking those keys. They're assisted by the fact that in the early period, the Germans don't change the keys very often. We're used to daily key changes during the war, but in this early period, they were changing some aspects of the settings monthly and other settings only quarterly. So if you could figure out one key, it would actually keep you going for quite a long time.
The Russian attack on Finland, or as the Russians call it, their counterattack against Finnish aggression, has, according to United Press reports, succeeded in 18 hours in attaining its primary objective, the resignation of the Finnish government. At least that is what the Russians have said is their objective, the replacement of the Kajander ministry by one which would be more friendly to Russia and would presumably be willing to give up the fortified frontier in Karelia and let the Russians have their naval base at Hanga, which the Kajander ministry has refused. In the first of the five air raids on Helsinki today, Russian planes dropped leaflets saying they had no wish to harm the Finnish people, and if they only got rid of Kajander, Foreign Minister Erko, and General Mannerheim, everything would be all right. But later air raiders dropped bombs, not leaflets. Several fires were started in Helsinki, 40 people were killed and 120 wounded there, according to a Finnish broadcast picked up in London tonight, and Viborg, Hunga, and other cities were also bombed. Tonight, a report spread through the Finnish capital that unless Finland made a complete surrender by 3 o'clock in the morning, that is 8 p.m. New York time, Helsinki and the other cities would be wiped off the map by air raids, leaving not even a trace. The Finns claim to have held the Russians in the land fighting on the Karelian border, but the first day of the war evidently showed them that their 150 airplanes were helpless against the Russian Air Force, which outnumbers them 20 or 30 to 1. A Moscow dispatch tonight says that political observers there think that with the Kayander government out of the way, the Russians will consent to an armistice and resumption of negotiations, but there's nothing official yet. Public sentiment almost all over the world seems to regard the Russian attack on Finland as the worst of all the recent attacks by great powers on small states, since until last Sunday evening, the Russians had not accused the Finns of anything except having something Russia wanted. And their subsequent stories of frontier incidents are not taken very seriously outside of Russia. German newspapers, up to the time our last dispatches were received, a little more than an hour ago, had printed nothing at all about the fighting in Finland. On the ground, as one German authority put it, that, quote, we have no confirmation of the news and the German press never publishes anything that is not fully confirmed, end quote. As W.L. White reported from Berlin on this network earlier in the evening, the German newspapers are printing a great deal about a worldwide wave of indignation, but that is about the British blockade.
What techniques did the Polish develop to find these keys?
What they did was they collected lots and lots of messages that the Germans were sending. As I say, the Germans are mostly training exercises, but they still have intelligence value because they give you a lot of information about the German order of battle, you know, how many units there are, how they're talking to each other, and how they're maneuvering when they do their exercises. So it's definitely stuff that's worth reading. Each message doesn't just have the ciphertext. It has what's known as a preamble at the beginning of it. If we were talking about an email nowadays, we'd talk about like a message header, whatever. And this has, it says call signs in it. It has who the message is from, who it's to, information about the time when it was sent, information about how long the message is. But critically, it also has the individual starting position that the Enigma operator has used to encrypt that particular message. Each Enigma operator would be given a basic key, which he would use for a day or a week or a month or whatever. But in addition to that, he would set the rotors of his machine to a particular starting position for each individual message. And that information was then embedded in this preamble to the message. And they didn't just put it in there in plain text. They actually encrypted the setting using the Enigma.
I was going to ask, otherwise it would be quite clear how to decipher the message, surely, yes. If the setting's right,
yes.
There.
So what they would do is they would have a daily ground setting, as it was called. They'd have a daily position for the three rotors, which was on a piece of paper and was secret. And they would pick the setting they were going to use for their particular message. And they would then set the machine to the ground setting and encrypt their individual message setting. And then that's what would go in the message. But what they were doing in order to prevent errors and garbles was they would encrypt the three letters of the message setting twice. And that's a really crucial flaw, because when you do that, a code breaker looking at it knows that of the six letters he's got, the three letters of the setting encrypted twice, the letter in position one and the letter in position four are both encrypting the same letter of the original setting. Similarly, two and five are the same, three and six are the same. And the Poles worked out that the machine isn't creating these letters randomly. It's pseudo-random. I mean, they are following a pattern because the rotors are moving in a predictable way.
But it's a pattern that repeats after such an enormous interval.
That it appears random to the layperson. And they were able to work out that there are recognizable patterns in these repeated message settings. This is a very complicated process because the only way to work out what the repeated patterns are is to go through all 17,000 positions of the Enigma and work them out. But they did this, and they basically created catalogues of all of the different combinations, the different settings of the machine that would produce these repetitions. And basically, they use several different techniques in the 1930s to exploit these repetitions. And this climaxes with the production of the Bomber, which is the first sort of mechanical device applied to key finding for Enigma. And what the Bomber did was it cycled through all of the possible settings of the rotors, all 17,000 of them, very quickly, and it would kind of spit out the occasions when these repeated letters in the preamble would occur. So for most of the 1930s, they are doing this work using these paper catalogues and in a very laborious sort of mathematical way. by the late 1930s, they have devised their bomber machine and they mechanize the process, and it actually gets very, very efficient, so that they are able by 1938-39 to break a German message in as little as a couple of hours. So they're reading by that point huge amounts of German Enigma traffic.
And this is the first example of using mechanical devices to help decipher Enigma.
Yes, and we'll talk a little bit more about the British bomb later on, but the British bomb, although it uses a different technique to key find on Enigma, it definitely has an ancestry that leads back to this Polish machine, because what the Poles do is demonstrate that you can build a machine to do this task. Even though the British machine does the task in a slightly different way, Turing was taken to see the bomber, but there's a lineage there. And if you want to talk about the very first purpose-built cipher-breaking machines, the bomber is certainly one.
The bomber was a successful tool. Why didn't the British just build a bomber?
Well, the British potentially could have built a bomber, but this takes us forward to the kind of the next chapter in the story, because the Poles are having all this success. The British are having limited success with the Spanish Civil War machine without the plugboard. But in 1939, the British are increasingly aware, and the French are increasingly aware, that German military Enigma is going to become a problem and they need to figure out how to deal with this. And the Poles at the same time are increasingly aware, you know, we've had the Munich crisis in 1938. The Poles are pretty sure that the balloon's going to go up and they're going to get attacked by the Germans sooner or later. So they're keen to share the progress they've made with their allies. And the consequence of that is there are two meetings. There's one meeting in January between the British, the French and the Poles, which isn't an enormous success because it's kind of everybody kind of feeling each other out a little bit. But the really crucial meeting happens in July. And at that meeting in July 1939, three representatives from GCNCS, who are Denniston, who's the boss, Dilly Knox, who's the current Enigma expert, if you like, and another chap called Humphrey Sandwith, who was a radio specialist for naval intelligence. He was more involved with the kind of the interception and the why side of things. A certain amount of hilarity and confusion with the French and the Poles, because they thought his name was Sandwich. And they're, who is this Mr. Sandwich? And this must be a cover name for him. Actually, his name was Sandwith. So those three go to Warsaw, and that meeting is absolutely fundamental to the subsequent breaking of Enigma, because the Poles were able to take Knox and Denniston and the French around everything they'd done. They showed them the bomber, they showed them the various other techniques they developed, and it was a real eye-opener for the British and the French. Knox in particular, he's been working on the military Enigma for some time at that point, but he's kind of hit a block, because there's a certain part of the machine where the static wiring from the keyboard connects with the moving rotors. And that entry wheel, as it's called, was wired in a particular way. And Knox hadn't been able to figure out what that wiring was. And until he could figure out what that wiring was, his attempts to break the machine more fully weren't going to work. And the Poles had actually succeeded in figuring out what the entry wheel wiring was. And the first thing they did was tell him. A certain scene results, because actually the Germans hadn't done anything complicated at all. The wiring was literally A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, which Knox had thought it wouldn't be because it was too simple, so he hadn't tried it. And Denniston describes how he got actually quite irate about this. And, you know, he wasn't the most temperate man anyway, Knox. He's notorious for flying off the handle about all sorts of different things.
I confess I was unable to understand the lines of reasoning when, as seems part of the conference, we were taken down to an underground room full of electrical equipment and introduced to the bombs. I did then grasp the results of their reasoning and their method of solving the daily key. Knox accompanied us throughout but maintained a stony silence and was obviously extremely angry about something.
And this was clearly playing on Knox's mind, because after the meeting had finished and they were travelling back to the hotel in the car, Knox returned to the theme.
He suddenly let himself go and, assuming that no one understood any English, raged and raged that they were lying to us now, as in Paris. The whole thing was a fraud. That he kept repeating. They never worked it out. They pinched it years ago and have followed developments as anyone could, but they must have bought it or pinched it.
Once the dust had settled, though, from Knox, this was a massively important moment, because the information that the Poles were able to provide meant that the French and the British had the potential to break the military Enigma much quicker than they otherwise would have done. Academics argue you know, would Knox have figured it out eventually? Yes, he potentially would have. But they get a huge head start from the information the Poles were able to provide. One of the problems that the Poles have at this point is, as we said earlier, the Germans have moved to using 5 rotors in their Enigma. And as we said, that changes the number of possibilities from 6 to 60. Any one bomber machine was built to only use one arrangement of rotors. So the Poles had had to build 6 machines to cope with all the different possibilities. Suddenly they're now confronted with the idea that they have to build 60 machines. And building 60 bombers just wasn't within the capabilities of the Bureau Shifrov at that point. Their factory that had been building Enigmas in the time it had been running, you know, in the last 6 or 7 years, whatever it was, had only actually managed to build about 17 Enigma machines. So the idea of building 60 bombers was just not realistic for the resources the Poles had at that point. And actually, the procedure that the Germans were using, that the bomber exploited, the Germans changed that procedure in 1940.
So even if the British had had the capacity to build 60 bombers, it still wouldn't
have... They would have become obsolete about 6 months later, unfortunately. So it's a great step forward at the time, but it's not the permanent solution, if you like. The other consequence of these events is that one of these Enigma analog machines that the Poles have built, they donate to GCNCS, and this is passed on by Bertrand, the head of the French service. We have this wonderful kind of spy moment when Bertrand brought the machine on the boat train from Paris, and he was met by Mingys, who was head of SIS at the time. Mingys was on his way to a dinner appointment, so he was on Victoria Station in sort of dinner jacket and raincoat, and Bertrand approached him with a, you know, carnation in his lapel and an Enigma machine in his briefcase.
Wow.
And the handing over that machine was also really, really helpful for the British because it allowed them to understand and, you know, mimic the functioning of the machine really, really easily.
At this point, the Polish codebreakers we were hearing about before, they were based in France?
At that point, in July and August 1939, they are still in Poland. They had been working in the Polish war ministry, if you like. There's a very large Saxon palace in the centre of Warsaw, which was the headquarters of their armed forces. And the Bureau Shifrov was installed in there for much of the 1930s. In the late 1930s, they built a specialist, much more secret centre for them in a place called Piri. There's a very large forest just south of Warsaw, and they found a suitably discreet part of the forest and built a kind of semi-underground bunker complex, which is where they moved their cryptographic service to, and that's where the bomber were installed. And the whole thing was kept much more out of the public view. That site still survives. It's actually operated by part of the Polish government meteorological office nowadays. That's where Denison and Knox went to Piri. They probably would have gone to the ministry as well. The original Saxon Palace ministry building was completely demolished by the Nazis during the war, so it no longer survives. But the Piri site is still there. And of course, having handed on all this material, the next thing that happens, 1st of September 1939, is the Germans invade Poland. And the cryptographic operation in Poland has to basically shut down. They destroy the bombers, they destroy a lot of the Enigmas, and the codebreakers have to flee, initially through Czechoslovakia. And they make their way to France. When they get to France, as we described earlier, it's still that phony war period. France still hasn't been attacked. And so the Poles re-establish themselves with Bertrand in Paris, and they continue their work on Enigma in Paris. But they're constrained by the fact they haven't been able to bring a bomber with them. They brought a couple of Enigma analog machines with them, but that's basically all they've got. And actually, the French start manufacturing Enigma analogs on behalf of the Poles in France. And the machine that's in the Pilsudski Institute is actually one of the ones that was manufactured in France under Polish instruction. It's not one of the original machines from Poland, because all of the original ones from Poland got destroyed.
Did any of these 3 Polish cryptographers we've been talking about ever come to Bletchley Park?
Ironically, none of them did. They carried on working for the French in Paris, and then after the French armistice, they moved south into the Vichy-administered part of France, and they stayed working for the French down there. It's only when the Germans occupy Vichy France that the Polish codebreakers, or some of them, move to the UK. At that point, they start doing work for the Polish government in exile, and so they never actually make it to Bletchley. It is one of the ironies of the story that the first people to break Enigma on the Polish side never actually came here.
The Finns stopped the Russians thoroughly today in the neighborhood of Suomussalmi, where they claim to have completely destroyed 3 Russian regiments which were dislodged from their positions a few days ago. For the moment, the dangerous Russian attacks in central Finland seem to have been brought to a standstill, and the question now is whether the Finns can shift enough troops to the northern front. On the Karelian Isthmus, Russian assaults were again repulsed. The Finns say they destroyed 36 tanks today and a total of 212 since the war began, but the Russians still have about 5,000 left. The 1st Division of Canadian troops under Major General Andrew McNaughton disembarked in England yesterday and today and will undergo some training there before going to the front. The biggest air fight of the war took place off the German coast, apparently all the way from Wilhelmshaven to the Danish frontier, but it's pretty hard to find out what happened from the stories told by the opposing sides. The Germans say they shot down 34 British planes and lost only two of their own, whose crews saved themselves by parachute. The British say they lost only 7, not 34, and brought down 12 Germans. A few bombs were dropped at Wilhelmshaven, but apparently they missed their mark. Several ship sinkings today, but all small. A Norwegian freighter was mined and sunk with 5 killed, which brings the number of neutral Norwegian lives lost in the mine and submarine campaign to 99. German airplanes in the past 2 days have attacked many trawlers and other small craft off the British coast and have sunk half a dozen of them. And the Maritime Commission gave permission to the United States lines to put the big liners Manhattan and Washington back into service, running to Italian ports outside the combat areas.
After the fall of Poland, the Polish codebreakers arrived in Paris. How does that impact what was going on at Bletchley Park in December, January 1940?
The Poles arrive in Paris and Zygalski, who was one of the Polish codebreakers, in addition to the bomber methodology, he had also developed a technique using what are named after him, what are called Zygalski sheets. And he had figured out that these repetitions of the preamble that we were talking about could be identified using cardboard sheets that had an alphabetical grid on them. And these sheets would be used to represent the various positions of the rotors in the machine. Basically, you took the sheet and it had two alphabets on it that represented two of the rotors. And you had 26 sheets, which represented each position of the third rotor. And they cut holes in the sheet to represent where these repeated letters would occur.
At the cross point of each axis.
So you end up with a sheet which has sort of 52 squares across and 52 squares down because the alphabets are repeated. And about probably 30, 40% of the boxes on it have a little hole cut in them. And what this means is by stacking the sheets over a light box and manipulating them to represent the particular settings of the machine, the holes in the cards overlap. And then the light shows through from underneath, and you can use this to work out which rotors are being used and what the settings of the machine are. It's a sort of manual sort of manipulation method. Zygalski had demonstrated this successfully previously, but he has the same problem that the Poles have with the bomber, that you need 156 cards to represent the 6 possible rotor orders.
All stacked in one pile?
You don't stack them all at the same time,
right?
But you need 156 because you need 6 sets of 26, because each set represents one set of rotor positions. So if you've got 3 rotors, you've got 6 choices of rotor positions. So you need 6 sets of 26. So that's 156 sheets.
And they all have to be perforated by hand.
Perforated by hand with these, you know, 52 by 52 grids. And he'd done that. But like with having to build 60 bombs, once the Germans go to 5 rotors, you now need 60 sets of sheets. So you go from needing 156 cardboard sheets to 1,560 cardboard sheets. But it was decided by GCNCS that this was an effort worth attempting. And an unfortunate mathematician called John Jeffries, who had arrived from Cambridge to Bletchley in September 1939, is tasked with putting a team together and creating 1,560 cardboard sheets.
Are Zygalski sheets known as Jeffries sheets?
Yes, they get referred to as Jeffries sheets or Zygalski sheets, or the technique is also referred to as NETs. NETZ. So you sometimes hear about NETS sheets. All of these basically are the same thing. Not only did they decide to cut 1,560, they decided to do a set for the Poles as a present as well. So they cut 2 batches of these cards. Jeffries sets out on this task in September 1939, more or less as soon as he arrives. But you can imagine it takes months to do. They start off using razor blades to cut each hole individually. After a while, they develop a kind of mechanical punch machine that speeds the process up a little bit. But it still takes absolutely ages. And having started in September, it's not until January 1940 that they complete the process. Partway through, I think it's in sort of November or December, someone calculates that they're about to punch the 2 millionth hole in a sheet of cardboard. And so Denniston is invited down to punch the 2 millionth hole.
Celebratory
punch. It's a sort of celebratory punch moment. I'm not exactly sure. I haven't done the maths to work out how far through the process 2 million holes was. So come January, Jeffries comes in and says, right, I have two finished sets of Jeffries sheets, Zagalski sheets. And so the plan is to send one set to the Poles in Paris, partly as a gift to them, but also because Zagalski is the man who's the real expert in manipulating these things, and it would be useful to get him to kind of demonstrate the system and work it all out. Because at that point, the British, although they've made these sheets, they're struggling to get them to work. There's a lot of pressure to get them operating as soon as possible. At this point, Knox writes another of his spectacular letters to Denniston.
The Cottage, 7th of January, 1940. My dear Denniston, as you remember on our journey to Warsaw, I promised to assist the Poles and the French in producing statistics. Actually, we have produced these, or similar statistics, and in a third of the time that all three parties could have been expected to produce them. But I hold, if only on personal grounds, that the statistics must be handed over at once. They were delayed for two reasons only. Number one, to devise a scheme of mechanical reproduction. And this problem has been solved without using the nets themselves. Number two, in order to see whether both upper and under copies were needed at once. The answer here is no. My personal feelings on the matter are so strong that, unless they leave by Wednesday night, I shall tender my resignation. I do not want to go to Paris, but if you cannot secure another messenger, I am actually at the moment completely idle. Yours ever, Dilwyn Knox.
Knox doesn't have to resign because Turing gets the job of taking the sheets to Paris. And so he sets off to Paris with one set of Zagalski sheets in his bag. And on Wednesday, the 17th of January, in Paris, with Bertrand and the Polish team, the Poles demonstrate how to break a message using the sheets. And the first wartime break of an Enigma message takes place there in Paris. Also, the Poles are able to point out that there has been a minor misunderstanding in how the British are using the sheets, which is why they've not had any success up to that point. And Turing has a kind of light bulb moment. He goes, aha, right, I now see what we've been doing wrong. And he then gets the train back, and he gets back to London on the Friday, which is the 19th. At this point in the war, GCNCS are not fully on 24-hour shifts, so he's not back in work until Monday. He has the weekend. And he comes into work on Monday, which is the 22nd of January. They get the sheets out, and with the corrected technique that Turing has brought back from Paris, the Enigma team at Bletchley are able to break their first message.
And what do we know about this message?
We know that it wasn't a particularly recent message. The first one they broke was actually from 25th of October 1939, so it was 3 or 4 months old by this point. And it was on a key codenamed Green at Bletchley, which wasn't an operational key anyway. It was a kind of training administrative key. So the content of that message was fundamentally unimportant, really. And we don't have that message, so I can't tell you what it said. The key thing was that they were able to do it. And then what they do from that point on is they start breaking more and more recent traffic. And we know that before the end of January, they are breaking messages from January, from relatively recent. They're not necessarily doing today's messages, but they're doing relatively recent messages. We know that because Denniston reports on that fact.
From Denniston to Mingus, CSS personnel, 25th of January, 1940. So far as I know, the only reason given to me by Bertrand on December 29th was that the French government were paying for the Polish army, and therefore the Poles must work in France. I think the loss will be theirs, though we should have welcomed a visit merely to see if we could have learnt any practical new methods from these men, who had had long experience of working on the machine. In the meantime, Knox has been working on a speeding up process, which has proved very successful and produced the keys for October 25th and January 17th. We have sent these keys to France and will continue to keep Bertrand informed of all progress in methods. We think the estimate of half a day to find the key of the day a little optimistic.
Having broken that first message at Bletchley Park, what happened next?
The simple version is that Bletchley carries on breaking Enigma messages in increasing numbers from that moment until the end of the war. The more complicated version is that that's not actually how they do it. In parallel to the work on the Zagalski sheets with Jeffries, Turing and Knox have been working on a different approach to breaking Enigma, which relies on cribbing, which is basically guessing the content of the actual message not using any of this preamble information, but working on the message text itself. And that technique is the technique that is mechanized in the Turing-Welshman bomb machine, which comes along later. And these two processes have been going on in parallel. So the first commission to build a bomb is in November 1939. So BTM in Letchworth are already working on building what will become the first bomb. And that wasn't delivered until March of 1940. Actually, when the first bomb is delivered in March, it doesn't work at all, really. And it needs to be modified, and Welshman's diagonal board needs to be fitted to it. And it becomes really effective in August of 1940. But what's been happening in the meanwhile is once Bletchley's able to break traffic using the sheets, they carry on breaking using the sheets in the meanwhile. And as I said earlier, Hut 6 has already been set up. The team that will move into Hut 6, the Enigma breaking team, have already been assembled so that they can start exploiting this traffic and break as much of it as they can straight away. The fact that Turing develops the bomb using a different technique is really, really important, because this repeated preamble that both the bomber and the Zygalski sheets rely on in German traffic, that is a procedure that the Germans abandon in May 1940. So even if they built 60 bombers, or if they carried on using Zygalski sheets, both of those systems would have become redundant in May 40 because they wouldn't have worked anymore.
So the fact that the bomb used a crib of the actual message text, that's not likely to change.
One of the really crucial things that gives the British bomb machine long life is the fact that it relies on attacking the message text itself, not on any of the preambles or the procedural data that surrounds the message, because those things do change at various points during the war. And Turing's method survives because it doesn't rely on any one specific procedural method. And also you can use the bomb for naval messages and army messages, because the Navy use a completely different settings procedure, a much more complicated one, which wouldn't have been amenable to Zygalski or bombers or anything else. But nonetheless, 22nd of January is significant because regardless of how they've done it, this is the first time that an Enigma message is successfully read at Bletchley Park. And from that point on, they just go on to break more and more messages, more and more keys every day. And as we've discussed previously, by 1944, 45, they're reading 3,000 of these things a day. So from small acorns, great oaks grow.
As some people may have seen in The Imitation Game, the first break of Enigma, there's whooping and joy and cheering and so on. Is there any record that we have of when that first Enigma break took place as to how people felt at Bletchley Park?
I've not come across any record of how people felt. The most direct account we have is Denniston's remarks about them then breaking further messages, but that's a rather routine, unemotional account of events. I suspect people like Jeffries and his team, having cut millions and millions of holes in sheets, would have been quite happy that it worked, even if only for a short time. And also, as we said at the beginning, it's the beginning of the work, not the end. When GCNCS moves to Bletchley, the German section is tiny because they can't read any German traffic, so there's not very much for them to do. Now they can read German traffic. Pandora's box has opened. They've now got an enormous amount of work to do, almost an unending amount of work to do. So there would have been a certain amount of, well, hey, we've done it. Oh, my God, what do we do now?
Ladies and gentlemen, the news which has come from Montevideo has been received with thankfulness in our island and with unconcealed satisfaction throughout the greater part of the world. The pocket battleship, Graf Spee, which has been for many weeks preying upon the trade of the South Atlantic, and met her doom. And throughout a vast expanse of water, the peaceful shipping of all nations may, for a spell at least, enjoy the freedom of the seas. Many vexatious tasks lie before the Royal Navy and before its comrades in the Merchant Navy, and as I always warn you, rough and violent times lie ahead. But everything that has happened since the beginning of this war should give the nation confidence that in the end, the difficulties will be surmounted, the problem solved, and duty done.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.